The title of today's talk is Senses versus Subtle Senses. A dog has between 220 and 300 million receptors for smelling. That's 40 times more than humans. A cat has 50 to 80 million, and that's 10 times more than humans. Humans have 6 million receptors, olfactor receptors. So you can see why dogs are used for tracking. And you can also see why we have a limited dependency on the sense of smell. We actually pick up and process combination of a fragrance or smell with the place or an idea, and that develops a pathway, a gate of remembrance in the human that makes up a little bit for the lack of what dogs are. If you ever wondered why a cat versus a dog has a, let's say, more aloof attitude around humans, you know that old joke, the cat's on the back of the sofa and the dog is at the foot of the sofa and the family's in the sofa and the dog is saying in thought form, "Ah, oh, family." And the cat is saying, "Ah, oh, servants." A cat has a more, let's say, developed relationship with the idea of hunting. It's easy for a cat to hunt down in a house even a, let's say, a mouse. So, but a dog is not going to eat a mouse. Probably won't even chase a mouse. Probably look at him, yawn, and go back to sleep. But cats are much more hunter. Dogs have become more human-oriented. So when you see the history of temple cats, like in Thailand or that, they have built in their temples little ridges at the top of rooms that a cat can walk. That's called a catwalk. And cats are used to patrol the temples. They don't need watchdogs. Because if someone comes in to the temple and wants to, like, say, steal a golden image of Buddha or something, the cat very quietly is walking around the perimeter at the ceiling. And if someone has the intention to steal something, the cat will leap off of the perimeter walkway and land on the cat, on the person's hand. And you know how cats like to bite and claw. If that doesn't work, another cat jumps on the neck. So the idea that the sensory mode is more alive in the sense for attack in a cat, because that's much easier for a cat to survive if it's been domesticated than a dog. A dog has to rummage in the garbage or chase down something, but it basically doesn't have as many options as a cat for survival of just little things. Cats will eat grasshoppers and bugs. Dogs won't. So they, you know, basically a cat is more aloof because a cat is more aloof, more capable of survival, thank you, without the family. So if the cat doesn't like what's going on, it may stray. A dog is much more, let's say, committed to the family and to the source of communal living and dependency on the love and care of the family. So every animal has its sensory capacities, including the physical human animal, of course. But the problem is that we have, let's say, deferred from subtle awareness to gross awareness and depend on verbalization for a lot of our sensitivity to well-beingness or to gross smells or to gross energy or noise. So it has to be fairly strong compared to what, say, a dog will pick up. And so a dog will have his hair stand up if someone is, let's say, a stranger coming up to the door. Oftentimes the dog will just react and his hair will stand up on his back and he'll growl. A cat just goes and hides. So, you know, and humans go answer the door, get shot. Because they don't sense that there's a motive other than somebody coming to the door. They've lost the sensitivity of measuring the subtle senses. And so they'll walk into situations that are not, let's say, favorable, like going to, let's say, competition of a sport of some sort. And let's say that there are some malevolent people who want to make an attack on this group of people. They're not going to pick it up. And so they're sitting ducks in the sense that they've walked into something, but the person who is planning it, or the persons who are planning it, are reeking of their intention, reeking of it. And a dog would pick it up, but not a human. They may get uneasy, but they won't know why. And so they'll discount it. And so, as I've said before, when I lived in New York, I had a dachshund, and I was taking him for his walk, and we came to the corner of the block, and he wouldn't let me go around the corner. He just, his hair stood up on his back, and he growled, and he wouldn't let me go around the corner. And I kept thinking, what's wrong with this dog, you know? And so as I got closer, a guy jumped out with a brick and would have, if he could have, if I had been close enough and my dog hadn't pulled me back, hit me and probably just grab my purse or something and run away. But the dog, way before the corner, already was growling and resisting going to the corner. So because we have become dependent on vocabulary, we don't realize how emotive we are and how emotive other animals are around thoughts. So if a thought is emoting, like say my dog picking it up, is emoting chemistry that is provocative to a very sensitive animal, that there's intention other than nobility, Sometimes you wonder why you just don't get on with somebody. And some people just don't get on with you. Let me see now, is it gross or subtle senses they're picking up on? As a man thinketh, as a man thinketh is getting recorded somewhere, so does he become. So as you think, you emote energy, you produce different frequencies. Now it may be that you're actually putting off fragrant frequencies. Why do the masters all have particular, let's say, fragrances that you can pick up even though they've left the body? Let's see now. Frankincense and myrrh, rose. You see, even the spirit level can create fragrance. And in fact, most fragrances are actually copies of other dimensional frequencies. When I talk about the idea that if you put a piece of radioactive material somewhere, it's going to radiate no matter what. Put it in water, put it in a can, whatever. Unless it's radioactive proofed, which is kind of, you know, you wonder about your wristwatches that are running on certain kinds of batteries, how much they are picking up. If my iWatch can tell me how many times I've taken a step, it's radiating something to measure that and picking up a radiation. You see? So you are emoting all kinds of frequencies. And you're picking up all kinds of frequencies. However, The problem is we don't take responsibility for that. We don't realize that, you know, you can say to an animal or another creature, "There, there, dear, don't worry, I'm not going to hurt you." And they just snarl at you. And they're snarling at you because you're putting off fear. And it, you may psychologically want to think you're too twine or condescending to this little creature, but the fact is you aren't trustworthy. And they pick up on your untrustworthiness. Well, even though we have a small aura factor and we have less receptivity, and other animals have greater receptivity, the fact is we have enough receptivity that we're picking up all the time on everything around us. But we're just not educating ourselves to understand and discern what we're picking up on clearly. No, I think that back in the old days when we had, you know, Cro-Magnon man and a few, let's say, more primitive forms of human activity and far less verbalization going on, that what happened is that the ancients actually were much more animal-like in their ability to be discerning by the sense of smell or by radiation. So if you put, as I began to say, the uranium-loaded something anywhere, it's going to radiate. And it's not going to discriminate. Its radiation can hit any surface, and whatever it does, that radiation to that surface is what it does, i.e., let's say, a human or an animal or whatever. So the radiation is not discriminatory, it's just radiating. And if it were discriminating, think of its targeted power. Now think about your thought patterns. You're in a crowd of people and you're looking around and you're having a surveying people and you're, let's say, categorizing. So not only are you radiating, but you're targeting. And that target is interpreted by the recipient. They may just feel uncomfortable. Ever had somebody just stare at you in a group and you turn and you know that you're being watched? The hair on your neck stands up or something, you see. But when you're walking around, you cannot plead innocent to your thought forms going out. Just can't. As a man thinketh. Every thought you're having has a target kind of energy to it that is going somewhere, something. See? So, if things are conscious, let's get back down to Ho'oponopono. he used to go into, Atulu used to go into a room before he was going to give a talk or have an interview or anything. And he'd do what he calls cleaning, which was saying, I'm sorry, please forgive me, I love you, thank you for being in my life, to everything in the room before a meeting. Like dusting the chairs with his thank yous, you see. Because how often do you look at a chair and say, I can't sit in that kind of chair? Or, you know, am I going to be on the corner? Am I going to be in the middle aisle? Am I going to be here? Or, you know, you've got a repertoire of thought patterns going on that you're not taking responsibility for or taking into account are happening. You don't even recognize that you're doing it 90% of the time. So let's say you're there for a play and you think you're a better actor than they are, or at least you're a real good critic, and you're sending vibrations of, you know, you're not very good. What do you think that's doing when you're targeting the power of your consciousness at them? And you have maybe 5 or 6 people in the audience that are doing the same thing. We're taught to be discriminating from day one. Well, think it through, you know. Can't you get that straight? What's the matter with you? Don't you understand things? You see, you're constantly being invited to be discriminating. And that has its upsides and it has its downsides. You want your children to be protective in the sense of don't talk to strangers. Yeah. I talked to a stranger and he tried to kidnap me, but when I was about 3. Luckily, I kicked him in the shins with a new pair of shoes, and you know how the old soles were leather and the edge would stick out. Hit him in the shins and he dropped me, and Elizabeth was there and he grabbed me by that and started running for home. But you see, being susceptible to language is a problem. And the whole idea that we are filled with conditioning and that we don't take responsibility for the fact that our thought forms are radiating and targeting. So, once again, why would Simran be useful? If you are in the process of consciously saying Simran, then you're not going to be unconsciously targeting people or things with your ill-conditioned conditioning that's been going on since day one, since you were a little kid. So the idea that everything has energy of one form or another, I mean, we have heat-seeking, you know, bombs. We have heat-seeking, let's say, scanners to look for animals in the forest or people who have escaped from a prison or whatever. They can use heat-seeking drones that can identify human radiation or dog radiation, whatever it's set to. And you don't have to say a word. And you don't have to be, let's say, saying, oh, there's a drone up there. You're just maybe hiding somewhere from the police or from somebody else. And this drone has already got you picked out because you're radiating. You always radiate. Until the soul leaves the body, you radiate. So, do you want to be grossly radiating, or do you want to be spiritually radiating? And that's where Cimarron is the thing that interrupts the pathology of human conditioning from the time we're little kids about one thing or another. You know, a little kid goes to pick up something that mommy or daddy doesn't want him to pick up, and they say, you know, before they even know what the name of it is, or even they would know what you're telling them, you make a sound or a gesture that interrupts their activity of picking it up, and you want it to retard their, let's say, willingness to pick it up when you're not around. So it's awful, you know. Ooh, that's a spider, it'll bite at, you know. And you go on and on. You've got a lot of sensory conditioning words that will train a child to react inappropriately. But what the parent thinks is protective. It's a very fine line between conditioning them to be hostile to their world and not available to the consciousness of things, and being, let's say, under the idea of the spirit being there and helping them be discerning about self-protection. To scare the kid to death is the typical Western behavior. American Indians are a little more subtle. American Indians tend to walk beside the child as he's learning that maybe this edge is not a safe place to be, but they don't give them the 1-2, you're gonna fall off and get killed routine. But their behavior is more to, you know, the spirit of the canyon deserves respect. You know, the spirit of the mountain deserves respect. So that what they're doing is they're opening a reciprocation of well-beingness in a place that might, in a Western mind, think is dangerous, and try and protect the kid from the danger. So we somehow, because of our closed lifestyles over the centuries of living in buildings and that sort of thing, have developed a kind of an adversarial relationship with creation, and feel that it's dangerous all the time, rather than alert to the fact that it's putting off a frequency that says, stand back. A waterfall is not inviting you to go stand in it. A waterfall is basically saying, you know, give me some room here. I'm coming down and spraying and that sort of thing. And we don't get it because we're the king of the hill. We're the manipulator. We can manipulate things. We can manipulate environments. We can manipulate things. And we don't see that in our manipulation, we're also not respecting the consciousness of other things. And therefore, we've lost the ability to be conscious. So, getting calmer and clearer and present and open-hearted and open-minded as much as we can is what's up. And that's what Cimarron is there to help do. It's not just an ego trip on God's part to say God's name. Hello, you know. God is the creator. God is creation. If it's all creation of the creator, and we're sending out exclusionary vibrations, then what happens is we don't get the appropriate loving inclusion of the creation. Our friend Hafiz has a few things to say on the subject. Where is the door to God? In the sound of a barking dog. In the ring of a hammer. In a drop of rain. In the face of everyone I see. That's called inclusionary. Once a man came to me and spoke for hours about his great visions of God he felt he was having. He asked me for the confirmation, saying, "Are these wondrous dreams true?" I replied, "How many goats do you have?" He looked surprised and said, "I'm speaking of sublime visions, and you ask about goats?" And I spoke again, saying, "Yes, brother, how many do you have?" "Well, Hafiz, I have 62. "And how many wives?" Again, he looked surprised and then said, "4. "How many rose bushes in your garden?" "How many children? Are your parents still alive? Do you feed the birds in winter?" And to all he answered, and then I said, "You asked me if I thought your visions were true." In a moment, this will work. And I would say that they were, if they make you become more human, more kind to every creature and plant that you know. Hmm. Ah, the intention of exclusion. The pawn always sits stunned, chained, unable to move beneath God's magnificent power. It is essential for the heart's coronation, for the pawn to realize there is nothing but divine movement in this world. And then you are like this, a small bird decorated with orange patches of light, waving your wings near my window, encouraging me with all of existence love to dance. And then you are like this, a cruel word that stabs me from the mouth of a strange costume you wear, a guise you had too long tricked me into thinking could be other than you, the beggar at the door. And then you are a firmament that spins at the end of a string in your hand that you offer to mine, saying, "Did you drop this? Surely this is yours." And then you are, and then you are, the beloved of every creature, revealed with such grandeur, bursting from each cell in my body. I kneel, I laugh, I weep, I sing, I sing. So, subtlety. But acceptance, there has to be a clear commitment to the idea that everything in creation is God. The Word, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God, and the Word brought everything into existence. The Word, in ancient Greek, which was what the translation of the Bible was in, the Word was logos, which is God power. Creative power, that which is all of creation and creative. So in the beginning was the Word, the Creator. And everything came into existence by way of the Creator. Everything came into existence by way of the Word. So, what is our selectivity? What is our, you know, resistance to what's around us? And then we keep thinking we're being spiritual. But the energy that we're wreaking is, well, that's that, and that's that, and that's that, and that's this, and that's that. And we're aiming, we're not only radiating it, but we're aiming it, which empowers it. So if you took a radioactive something and you put it in a radar gun and aimed it, what are you doing? If you are radiating the names of God, Now what are you doing? It's a whole different genre of energy that's coming out of you. And therefore, it doesn't have to be self-protective because you're not maliciously targeting it. It doesn't sound like you're maliciously targeting it. That's what it is. When you ignore it or condescend to it or, you know, that's like saying, well, let's say that a little child who's an orphan from war and that, which has happened over and over again. And many times people try to adopt these orphan children who have been put in huge orphanages and have had no, let's say, cuddle time or holding time or, you know, kindness other than keeping them fed and dry and that sort of thing. And when people adopt them, they never acclimatize. They never bond. Because during their developmental early age, they were a burden, they were rejected, they were hurt, they were bewildered, they didn't know what was going on, they were never consulted. And so they shut down the ability to be receptive to love, to caring. And so think about how many things you shut out of your life and don't realize you do. How you demean things by minimizing them or thinking they're bad and awful and terrible and da-da. And that old story that he says in here, you fooled me. You wore a mask that I did not penetrate. We're constantly being given opportunities to ask for insight, as opposed to reactionalism, which is ego conditioning. You know, we all have it. We all got it. And we all have issues with it that we don't even realize we have. It's automatic in us to reject something, to put it over there, to think it's less than. So why do groups of people go to war? Because they've decided that this group over here has these problems. And I have frequently told this story when I was studying anthropology of tribes of people that had a what you might call a 25-mile radius of inclusionary people that were in their, let's say, inside their tribal okay circle. But if somebody went outside of the 25-mile radius into 35 miles and fell in love with someone out there, that was not good. You know they're all robbers, and you know that they're not good people. But if you bring them into the 25-mile radius, we'll accept them, but we'll keep our eye on them. But if you go out beyond the 35-mile radius, those people walk upside down, underground, and murder for no provocation. Now that was a tribal belief. So We have a lot of those. Why people who haven't traveled, let's say internationally, and have had maybe some kind of conditioning that this is bad and that is bad, they are loath to travel outside of comfort zone. They don't want to end up somewhere, South America, in Africa or Far East or whatever, It's dangerous. It's always dangerous. And you have to be on guard. So, are you receptive or are you rejecting and not owning it because you've been conditioned? Well, we all have our limitations and we all have our conditioning, period. That's just the way it is. And so, undoing that is when we say Simran, when we're doing things, we're standing back and giving space to acceptance of something that we would automatically maybe reject. So instead of thinking that, the beggar at the door is dangerous, the beggar at the door may be perfectly God. Oh, really? Isn't that what Mother Teresa was all about? Yeah, you see. And it's very trying on your nervous system to undo that. And that's why saying Simran is so important, because if you're addressing the frequency of God power, you're pulling it towards you as a quote-unquote invitation for God power to reveal itself, as opposed to our criticalness revealing itself in return criticalness. So we just don't understand the power of our thinking and our radiation. And so we don't understand the power of other things and its radiation, other people's radiation. And we victimize ourselves and we victimize them. Ah, yes. So Simran is the neutralizing agent. Love, if you're having a loving conversation with God's name, you see, the radiation is openness and inclusion rather than exclusion. And when we exclude, we get excluded. But we don't know it. We think it's somebody else's problem. Aha! How interesting the human conditioning is, the sensory world, and how wonderfully rich it could be if we allowed it to be, or reconditioned ourselves. Okay.